Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network, with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, at any time, and anywhere. And believe me, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about brain injury. And I didn't know about it, not until it came to live on my doorstep when my husband had a traumatic brain injury in 2005. So on Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. So on the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression or neural fatigue, anger, or various symptoms of brain injury. And there are so many, it's incredible. You can just go on and on. The topics are endless. So for those of you who are new to my show, I just want to tell you just a wee bit about how I came on the brain injury scene. And that was in 2005, which I mentioned earlier. My husband had a traumatic brain injury. And you can actually learn more about that on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Excuse me. One moment, please. I did not want to cough into the microphone, and it was coming, so excuse me, folks. But on my blog, Surviving Traumatic Brain Injury, it's written for brain injury survivors or caregivers or anyone who wants to learn more about it. And you can find out about our story there. It's called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. And that's my book that was published in 2018 after many, many, many years of writing it. But I share David's and my story through that book. It's a story that will make you laugh, it'll make you cry, and it'll make you gasp. That's how I like to describe it. And I have to also tell you that it reads like a novel. It's a memoir. It is nonfiction, but it reads like a novel, so it's an easy read. So you can also learn more about me at DonnaFugerski.com. That's my website, and that has a lot to do with Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You can even see the entire cast of characters there, pictures and all, and who they are, so you can identify the characters in the book. So I shared my David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 14th, when my show premiered, the last of which was in November of 2014, featured a discussion with David himself. So you can hear the story in four sessions here, and then with David talking about from his point of view. In April of 2020, actually April 19th, I also interviewed David again to show his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years. And because he is a retired professor of microbiology, I wanted to get his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. So on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, there are a lot of articles written by David that kind of deduces the information about COVID into layman's terms. So he takes what the scientists are saying and explains it so even I can understand it. So you can check out the blog there, and just on the sidebar, look for COVID-19. You can find all my shows at that same site at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click on the air show menu. It's a tab in the category section on the right sidebar. And that's really easy to find. I think, oh gosh, I'm going to forget more than 130 shows, probably more than that. I never know. Anyhow, there are a lot of shows. So, or you can type David Figurski, Figurski, in the search box in the right sidebar to learn more about you know, him and his story too. You can also read our complete story in my book, and I'm going to say this again, No Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and released in November 2018. You can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as an ebook and as a print book at all your local book cons. That would be your Amazon, your Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, Kobo. You can go on and on. Yeah, so find the book in your libraries, too. And if it's not in your library, ask for it. And what I was saying all last year is, my audiobook is coming. My audiobook is coming. Well, guess what, folks? It came, and it was released December 18th. So now even the audiobook is available for your listening pleasure. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. Go to any of the bookstore haunts to find the book. And I hope that you're going to find my show tonight fun and informative. And I hope that you will visit the shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows every night from, 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time on weekends, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays to listen to your favorite shows, too. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States and in 36 countries. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tonight's show we're calling What Survivors and Caregivers Want Others to Know, because we each have our issues as we become caregivers or survivors, and so it's always good to have that communication aspect out there. So sometimes there seems to be like a wall between survivors and their caregivers, and between the survivor and the rest of the world, for that matter. Folks don't seem to understand what is making their survivor tick. They don't sometimes act the same way that they did before their brain injury, and other people don't quite understand why. Well, frankly, other survivors don't know what is making them tick either. So it's a scary, confusing world behind the wall of brain injury. So tonight, my panel and I want to delve into how to make the world of survivors and caregivers mesh more easily. And I think the key is communication. And that's just what we're going to discuss tonight. So I am the caregiver, as I already mentioned, for my husband, David. And with me are two survivors of brain injury, Deb Brandon and Jamie Crane Mosey. So let me tell you a little bit about each of them before we get started. I want to start with Deb, and she is a brain injury survivor and the author of her books, But My Brain Has Other Ideas, a memoir of recovery from brain injury. Deb is also a retired professor of mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University. That's my old stomping ground, by the way. I was born in the Pittsburgh area and went to college in the Pittsburgh area. So it's always fun to talk to Deb because I can recognize some of the places that, you know, she's hanging out around. So she's in the process. Deb's in the process of writing a second memoir of living with brain injury rather than recovery from brain injury. So you can read about Deb on my blog, SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com, and in the search box, type her name, Deb Brandon. Excuse me, something's going on with my throat today. A Survivor Speak Out interview will pop up, and so will several shows of Another Fork in the Road on which Deb has appeared. And you can learn more about Deb at her website, DebBrandon.com. So check it out, folks. And I have to go back over here for a second to see Jamie's bio. She just sent me a new bio today. And Jamie Mo Crazy grew up on the ski slopes. Excuse me, I'm going to mute again. I'm so sorry. We'll try this again. I apologize. Jamie Mo Crazy grew up on the ski slopes. By the time she was 18 years old, she had won junior world championships and moved to Utah to continue training as a professional slopestyle and half-pipe skier. However, in 2015, Jamie crashed at the World Tour Finals, went into a coma, and became paralyzed. In an instant, Jamie went from being one of the world's best slope skiers to relearning basic gross motor skills like walking upstairs and riding a bike. She worked hard. Jamie didn't let the results of this horrific accident keep her down. Instead, she worked hard to recover, leaning on her friends and family for support, and charged forward in life with optimism. And I can attest to that. That girl has so much energy and gets so involved in so many different things. And I'm going to ask Jamie right now, before we get into our our show, to just tell us a little bit about what's going on in your life right now, Jamie.
Hi, Donna. It's a pleasure to be on this show. I'm really excited that you offered me an opportunity to come and talk with you, because I love that. I've been working with you for years now, and our relationship is just awesome. I think so highly of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So one of the things I think we were talking about before we went live was that the Mo Crazy Strong team, which consists of my mom, Mama Fruit, who is quite often on Donna's shows, and my sister Jeannie, and I, Jeannie was instantly tossed into being a caregiver. We are part of the Mo Crazy Strong core team, the three of us. And so one of the things we're doing is we are running a campaign for the month of March, which is Brain Injury Awareness Month, for the Utah Brain Injury Alliance. And so it's focused at caregivers. And we're really excited about this, because this has been Mama Fruit's dream since, honestly, before I even had an accident. You know something that you might not know, Donna? A week before my brain injury, Mama Fruit, was writing an article about how you can rebuild your synaptic connections after a brain injury by creating habits in your life. So she wrote a whole article on it. And then she had the case study in the sense of her daughter had a brain injury. And so She has been studying the brain for over 30 years. And the fact that she got to use her neuroscience understanding, her master's in psychology understanding, and work, and be able to tune that all together and create these outcomes for her daughter was tremendous. And now the fact that she gets to share that information with the world is so cool, because You know what? If you want to learn about unexpected trauma, and you go be a doctor, you're going to study. You're going to go to medical school, and then you're going to do your residency. It's going to be about 10 years until someone's life is in your hands. Yet if you become a caregiver of an eye and you don't go to school for it, and there's no material out there to teach you the opportunities that you can have as a caregiver for your survivor. So we're so excited to be able to do this. We're going to be having 10 different videos over the month, and we're going to be having different printout visuals that go with the videos, and we're going to be talking to the State House about the laws concerning brain injury. We have a whole month plan that we've been working with our talent agent about and stuff like that, but it's so exciting that we actually have the opportunity to be able to make a voice for brain injury caregivers, because honestly, that's a really, really challenging thing that you are thrust into automatically. And so, Donna, you pointed out that 5 million people in the U.S. have brain injuries. They all have families. They all have caregivers.
That's right.
Many have multiple caregivers. So if there's 5 million people and they have 3 caregivers each, you might think 15 million people are affected every year by it, because caregivers are affected just as much as survivors are.
You are so right on that. And that's a lot. That's one of the things that I think people don't understand at all. Is that brain injury is not an isolated event. It affects not only the survivor, but it does affect the people around them. It affects their primary caregiver, but it also affects the other members of the family, both primary members and extended members. It affects their friends outside of their family. So, yeah, it's not something you just you can do alone. You know, and the caregivers are affected greatly. So I'm really excited to hear that you're getting involved in something so big like this, Jamie. That's wonderful. And if there's any way I can help, I'd be happy to step in. So let me know.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So Deb and Jamie, I want to just go back now into our of the conversation about what caregivers and survivors need to know about brain injury. Do you both agree that communication is the core for the understanding between survivors and caregivers, and between survivors and the rest of the world?
Absolutely. I mean, communication is huge. I mean, I know that, for instance, my first caregiver is my ex-husband, and part of what broke down between us was communication. That was a big part of it. Now, there were some other sides to it, which were, you know, to do with our personal relationship. But, I mean, without communication, I can't even begin to imagine. I wouldn't have, you know, I have good friends now from this, through this whole journey, and communication is what lies behind it all.
Yes, I also agree. Communication is so important. And I had 2 main caregivers. My mom, Mama Fruit, was definitely the head, and she was fantastic and wonderful. The amount of education and science she brought to being into my caregiver was so cool. And then on top of that, so she kind of like ran it, but then all of my family was involved. And my little sister, Jeannie, she was a very involved caregiver as well. And one of the big things with Jeannie and I that was challenging was, and it has to do with communication, is that instantly she went from somebody whose big sister, she was at World Tour Finals. It was her first ever World Tour Finals. Super excited. She was supposed to compete in halfpipe the next day. She's watching her older sister, who I would always organize the parties, and I was the ringleader, and she was my follow. Like we loved each other, but she would follow me. And then all of a sudden, after she gave me a hug, I dropped in for my run. She saw me convulsing on the snow, spewing blood. My eyes rolled back in my head. My fatality report was actually written when I left.
Yeah.
and was airlifted to Vancouver General Hospital, but never signed. And so instantly, in that moment, she went from someone who was following me to being a caregiver. And the communication was challenging because the role reversal, which happens to a lot of people, especially like what you were mentioning with your husband, in a relationship with a husband, you're usually on an equal level. The man and the wife are both equal. Yet if you become mm-hmm. the caregiver, you are at a higher level than the person you're caring for, and that gets so awkward. And then when they get back to their own independence and they step out, it's kind of like a teenager stepping out on their own again. Yet my little uh-huh. sister Jeannie had never had a teenager, and we had so much strain in our relationship when I started doing things on my own again, and I still had a lot of deficits from the brain injury at that point in my life. And so to be like a teenager still makes a lot of mistakes. And so to be able to step out on my own and still make mistakes and watch that, the whole role reversal is so confusing that if you don't communicate about what you want, what stage you're at, and just how things are going all the time, then it's going to be much more stressful.
I guess my oldest son, he was 15 when I had my brain injury. And I didn't think about it until what you said, Jamie. He was in many ways one of my caregivers, and we always communicated very well, and I think that's what made it work. I mean, I was actually, when he went on to college, I was worried that he wouldn't want to leave the area because he'd be worried about me, because he was always there in the background, ready to step in if needed. And I was really happy that when he ended up going to college, he ended up living in the dorms and all that. I was really happy that he did that. And later on, then he moved back in. But again, he lives with his partner. But just the reason it worked so well with us is, as he said, is the fact that we communicated so well. I just didn't think about it. Think about him as a caregiver. For the longest time, I didn't want to ask my kids for help because I didn't want them to worry and I didn't want to be a burden on them, this kind mm-hmm. of thing. And when I was on my first year anniversary, I was crying and I was walking with my son and my friend over to the docks for dragon boat practice, and I was crying because I realized that it was my anniversary and, you know, PTSD type stuff. And and I stopped he was walking ahead, and then when I saw him, I stopped and, you know, dried my eyes and this kind of thing. And my friend said to me, you know, you should be honest with him because he deserves that respect. And as soon as she put it like that, that's when I realized that, yes, I need to be open with my kids about it. And that really, you know, once that was really a jarring reality check. Mm-hmm. And that's when I became open about it, the kids were more helpful. My daughter wasn't as much. She was younger. But my son was amazing throughout. I mean, he was right there communicating. You know, he was being my advocate in many, many ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is so key to getting the help that you need, because so often mm-hmm. survivors don't let on that they need help.
Right.
You know, because especially in the relationship you had with your children, you're the parent. You're the one that's supposed mm-hmm. to be taking care of them. They're not supposed mm-hmm. to be taking care of you. And it just totally upsets the whole norm. And so it's difficult to understand that. But again, when it does, you know, it does happen, and they want to help. I mean, obviously they want to help. Their human nature comes in, and they see their mom in pain or having difficulties, they're going to step up. So I think the communication part, when you discuss it with them, it makes them feel more grown up too. It makes them feel more included in that kind of an aspect.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing that happened. But it takes a while because, you know, you don't think of your child being a caregiver. And even in my situation, I was a caregiver I'm a caregiver now for 16 years, more than 16 years. But I didn't realize I was a caregiver until about, let's see, 9 or 10 of them went by. Now, that's kind of crazy, but I never put that label on me. I never thought about being a caregiver. I just felt like, okay, our life has changed. We're still going to continue on in our life with my husband, and I'll pick up the slack or do what I need to do to make everything easier on both him and on me. You know, but it really does. What I think when I realized that I was a caregiver, it made it more real in that sense that I realized I wasn't just picking up the slack. I really was consciously taking over a lot of things and making it easier for the two of us. It was interesting. I have to just do a quick announcement here, because for all those folks out there watching what's it called now? The Super Bowl game, you know, the one that the whole world is watching right now. And I would have been watching if the show weren't on, but on the computer. But anyhow, halftime is over, and I have to just make a couple announcements on that. The halftime is produced by one of my best friend's daughters. So she is backstage there getting that halftime show going. So I hope it's a good one. They usually are. So anyhow, David wants me to let you know that although he is listening to our show, he has the game on mute and he is watching it. So the third quarter has started, and Tampa Bay is at 21 and Kansas City is at 6. And Kansas City just received the kickoff, and now they probably have another score by now because he gave that to me 5 minutes ago. But I am being the sports recorder right now, or sports reporter. So, yeah.
What about communication?
It's humorous that you brought that up, because I'm actually at my the boy that my partner used to live with. It's not a big party because of COVID, but we have just a couple of people. It's like the most social thing I've done in months. But we're there, and I'm actually on the back porch, and I'm walking around, and it's all snowy I was downstairs. And that's when my phone connection wasn't working, and so I came upstairs.
Oh, no.
So I had more bars on my phone, and so I wouldn't drop out. And so they're all watching the football game right now as well.
And so we have you out. We have you out on a snowy porch. Freezing to be on the show.
Oh, I have a really nice jacket on. That actually leads right in, because I have my friend's really nice jacket on, and it's really warm and comfortable. And that leads me to what I was going to say before you talked about the Super Bowl stuff, and about how the communication goes beyond just communicating to your direct caregivers, but at the time of your traumatic brain injury. The rest of your people in your neighborhood surrounding you, they want to help. And, of course, that help might change a little bit with COVID happening, but, like, they can mow your grass. Like, for ours, like, they want to mow your grass. They want to do your dishes. They want to help because of the tragedy that happened. And they're waiting for you to ask them. And many survivors and survivors' families, they feel like they have to do all these things. And it's a really stressful, overwhelming situation. So there are people who are waiting to have you ask them and tell them what you need help with. And a lot of people are waiting for that. And a lot of survivors and families never ask and just do all the work themselves. And you can you can put that off on other people, and it'll make them feel so good. So you're actually making them feel good and productive that they can help you during this time in your life.
That's
I agree.
Very. I was just going to say the same thing. That is such an important point, Jamie, because people don't often want to ask for help because they feel they're putting other people out. But other people do want to help. You're right. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, Deb. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I think you had something to say to that, too.
No, I was going to say the same thing, and I had to ask for help, and that was a very tough lesson for me to learn, because, you know, I was this feisty, fiercely independent woman, and suddenly I'm not, and I have to expose my vulnerabilities because I needed the help, and it took me a while. I mean, in fact, my kids were the last ones that I realized that I need to ask them for help. I kept them out of it, and they did. My daughter felt, we talked about it a couple of years ago, and she said that she felt left out because I wasn't asking her for help. And she didn't know really what was going on with me because I didn't want to burden her. But yeah,
well, you
asking
were protecting
for help,
her.
That was a tough one. Yep.
Yeah. It's that mommy protection. You know, taking care of the little ones, keeping them out of the loop because you don't want them to be, like you said, burdened or hurt by it. So, it makes sense. So we all agree that communication is very important. And so now I want to look at some things that set survivors off and why. What bothers them? And what I found was commiseration is a huge problem. And typically family or friends want to make their survivors feel better. They don't want them to feel bad about their shortcomings. So they often make comments like, oh, don't worry, I forget things all the time too. When a survivor says, I can't find my keys, or I can't find this, or where's my library book, or whatever. Or it's not just you, I'm always tired too. And I hear you laughing, Deb, and I knew you'd laugh because we've talked about these things before. But really, I don't think that they are trying to minimize the survivor's problems. But I do think they are trying to make their survivors feel that their problems shouldn't worry them so much and that they are not alone. But the survivor hears is, you don't understand. You don't know what I'm going through. It's not simply forgetting or feeling tired on occasion. It's persistent. It's ongoing. So do platitudes help, or do they make our survivors feel worse? Do I even have to ask that question? But go ahead.
Well, I think that certainly at the beginning, it really got to me. My mother was like this a lot. I mean, when I explained to her about sensory overload, that I have trouble processing information, and that if there's too much coming at me, I have meltdowns and this kind of thing. And she said, well, I have trouble with that too. And I said, well, does it make you cry? Sometimes I feel like crying, and I'm going, oh God, just get me out of here. you know, neurofatigue. These are things that, you know, people don't get. But this is something that in general, not just for caregivers and survivors, we're back to communication. One has to, if possible, one has to try and put it in terms that a person can relate to. But as a brain injury survivor, certainly during the early days of recovery, you just can't.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's true.
Yeah,
Jamie,
so
do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. And one of the things that's so interesting is that everyone feels like they need to connect or experience everything. So beyond just a brain injury, anything you're happening, they say, oh, I understand. And that was the thing that actually drove my sister, Jeannie, the most crazy at the time, was because she was having so much trauma when I was in the hospital and I was in my coma. And they didn't know if I was even ever going to wake up out of my coma, and I was like, oh, I understand. And she's like, no, you don't. You do not. Like, you don't you don't get this at all. And that's something that people always feel it's helpful to say, I understand. Well, the fact is, they don't. Now, another thing that adds to it is caregivers
want to be supportive. They really do. But it's so easy for them to confuse being supportive to being coddling. And if you say it's okay, or you try to diminish it, or you try to coddle it, and you try to say, oh, it's fine, then it can be really challenging for the survivor. One of the big things is instead of saying, oh, that's okay, this happens to me all the time, I lose my phone, everybody loses their phone. Look at it analytically. Say, okay, you lose your phone all the time. All right, well, this is what happened to me. Mama Fruit said, okay, you lose your phone all the time. You have no idea where it is. So what we're going to do is the first thing, every time you take your phone and you put it down, it leaves your hand, it is going to the bottom, the railing at the bottom of the stairs. That is the only place you are putting it down. So if I was upstairs, I'd have to walk all the way down to put my phone on the railing. And then once we had done that for a couple of weeks, we took the next step. We went to the next level in that program. But the next thing was every time I put my phone down, to say out loud three times, Jamie is putting her phone on the table. Jamie is putting her phone on the table. Jamie is putting the phone on the table. And say it out loud three times.
Yeah.
And then after we had done that for weeks and months, we went to the next step where I would say in my mind three times every time I put down my phone. And I still do that sometimes. And now I actually have a better retraction of my objects than most of my friends. And they say, how do you remember things so well? And it's because I learned all these steps to remember it. And the way I could do that is because instead of coddling or saying, oh, it's fine, Jamie, it's your new life, it's part of your brain injury, that's something that people say all the time too. It's fine. It's your new life. Or they say, oh, it's fine, I do it too, I always lose my phone too. But they aren't doing anything to actually fix the problem. You have a problem, you're voicing that you are losing your phone, an excessive amount of losing your phone. You have no idea where it is. So the solution is to find, to look at that problem analytically and take steps and create a program to get through and help your retention and your brain injury, your brain memory form again, that you can remember where you put your phone down because you took steps to get there. So instead of looking at every problem and saying, oh, I have that too, or trying to say it's part of your new life, look at it. I would suggest to look at it analytically and be like, okay, this is the problem. How can we solve it instead of just trying to brush it off?
But I think also people brush it off because it helps them. I mean, for instance, with my mother, I'm pretty sure that why she was doing the, telling me that I was always a napper and all this kind of stuff, it was her way of coping, as in if she diminished the problem, then the problem wasn't so bad and she didn't have to worry as much. But the thing is, I mean, it took me a long time to figure that out. In fact, my editor pointed it out to me, but until then I was really resentful when she did it. And once my editor pointed it out at me that it's my mother's way of coping, I really resented it whenever my mother was constantly doing that. But I mean, my father, on the other hand, went into problem solving mode whenever anything happened. So that really helped.
Yeah. And I think about what Jamie's talking there too is compensation. Trying to figure out another way around the problem. You called it analytical thinking, but finding another way around the problem and using that as a tool. And I think that so many survivors do have to do that kind of compensation, use those kind of compensation tactics just to get by. I'm going to interrupt the program for just a moment because I just got another notice that Tampa Bay scored a touchdown. So the score now is Tampa Bay 28, Kansas City 9, with 7 minutes left in the third quarter. Okay, thank you to David. He is my he's my behind the scenes announcer. So anyhow, I wanted to bring this up right now too, because some of the things that you brought up, Deb, are so familiar to me because for our audience members out there, I want you to know that Deb and I are right now in the process of writing a book, a new book, about what we call conversations. And it's about all these kinds of topics. and we're looking at it through the eyes of a caregiver and a survivor, pretty much like what we do every week on this show, or every 2 weeks on this show, is looking at the different problems in the survivor caregiver scene, and we're trying to parse it out a little bit and hope that it'll come out. Since December, the middle of December, we've popped out 4 chapters, so we're working steadily on that and hope to have something like that for you to enjoy sometime down the line. So moving on.
Well,
to
one
the
of the nice
question.
Things about it is that we're looking at issues from the different points of view. For instance, both survivor and caregiver grieve for their old life, but it's for different, for different reasons in different ways. And I think it's really important to understand. You've got the caregiver and the brain injury survivor. They're in the same boat in many ways, but their points of view are very different.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And that's what we are learning as we have our conversation every week before we sit down to write our parts of the book. So yeah, it's been a fun process so far, and I'm sure it's going to be a wonderful book that I hope everybody will just love. So going back to this now, another big issue that survivors balk about is not being believed when they talk about their issues, not taking their brain injuries seriously. And statements like, oh, it's all in your head, or stop using your brain injury as an excuse, or you're just being lazy. Those kinds of things can make survivors see red. And it's no wonder. Sometimes statements like that make survivors feel totally misunderstood and helpless. And it usually happens to survivors who show no outward signs of brain injury, because they appear fine on the outside. We call it invisible brain injury. And folks don't realize that the survivor's brains are in turmoil on the inside. So when brain injury survivors say that they are too tired for a Friday night date, and it's something that they may have planned already with their friends, you know, but all of a sudden they're backing out, or they feel discombobulated and they can't keep their schedule straight, or they constantly forget or lose things like we mentioned up above, they are crying out for understanding, you know, and that's what people just don't get. They're not being lazy. They're not using their brain injury as an excuse. It's what's happening in their world, and they're trying to let you know what's happening in their world. And sometimes for us on the other end of the stick there, the caregivers or the family members or friends don't quite understand it. So Jamie and Deb, are you – I don't even have to ask the question again. Are you both bothered by the lack of understanding from the folks in your lives? And
I have a friend
Go ahead.
I have a friend who, I don't know if she's my friend anymore. She told me I'm just unreliable as a friend because I've had to cancel on her at the last minute. And I tried to explain to her, but I know that she's very skeptical. And this is why I say I don't know if she's my friend anymore, because she hasn't been in touch with me for months, even though I've made contact, but she's just ignored me. It's when you see that skepticism, or you hear that, or you can't use that as an excuse anymore, at the very least it's upsetting, but I mean, at that point, what do you do? I mean, you can talk till you're blue in the face and it's not going to get the point across.
Yeah. They're just not going to understand. And it's a hard thing to understand, you know, because it does look like that when you want to go out with somebody, and if you don't really know the inside part of brain injury, it's difficult to understand why, you know, why someone can't go. You know, you've made the plans and now they're just backing out, and it looks like, well, I just don't care enough about you. I just don't want to do it, so I'm not going to go, you know, but that's why the awareness is so important. That's why we do these shows, or why we do the books, or why we do articles, because it helps people to understand the underlying symptoms and the underlying things that are going on within a brain injury survivor's brain.
I think also when you think about it, caregivers are in the same boat with that, because of being caregivers, they have to cancel things at the last moment. And again, I'm sure that's affected friendships and things like that.
Well, you lose a lot of friendships when you have a brain injury. And if you're the caregiver, well, those friendships go by the wayside too. You know, you kind of find out. But you know what? It's true. You do lose a lot of people. But afterwards, you gain so many more. And so many people that are so so empathetic and sympathetic to what's going on in your life. I mean, look at I'm sitting here talking to you and Jamie right now, to which I consider two very good friends that I would never have met, and include Jamie's mama in there too, Mama Fruit. You know, I would never have gotten to know you, and that just there are countless people that I do know now because of the brain injury. Now, what if I could turn back the clock and not have a brain injury? Yeah, I'd probably choose that. Sorry, girls. But but anyhow, you know, it's just that there are you make new pathways. You find another, you get to the fork in the road and you take another path is basically what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's interesting because for the first year, the person who is in the most denial was me. Fruit would say, what a great recovery you're making and all this stuff. And I refused to believe it was a bad accident. And people would ask me if I was in a medically induced coma, and I would say, absolutely. And I was in a natural coma. And they would ask me these questions, and I kind of associated it with a torn ACL. I was like, I would go back to skiing. When I left the hospital, fully believed that I was going to go back to competitive competition skiing again. And so then when I began to realize a year out how serious it had been, then that's when I realized I could have a voice and I could talk about it. And that really changed my life, was that I realized that I could go out there. And then one of the things, just touching on friends, so then for the next few years, from like 2 to 3 years out, I started seeing people again, and that was emotionally the most challenging for me because I had some friends who stuck with me and some friends who did not. And it was at that time when I was not cognitively all there. I had friends who could not deal with the changes in me, and they left. And they left my friendship, and I'm no longer friends with them. And I also made new friends, and I built these new friends who even had nothing to do with brain injury, because all of a sudden I wanted people who had these visions, these dreams beyond just ski bros and people who would just do lots of tricks and drink lots of beer. I wanted more in my life. I wanted meaning. I wanted purpose. So I found all these new friends. And quite honestly, I just have to say this because not very many people, most people think that if they had a brain injury, they wouldn't have it. If they had the choice, they would give it up. And quite honestly, I was a professional skier. I traveled the world competing. I had a really good life, and I would not give up my brain injury. I would not have necessarily chosen it at the time, but I'm so glad I had a brain injury because I learned so much from it. And now I'm able to make better plans with my friends. And the reason why is because I have 3 calendars. I put it on so many calendars, but I learned how to do that. And I've learned how to actually become friends with people on a soul level instead of just a superfluous level, and be able to talk to them deeply about the meanings and purpose in life. And I've grown so much as a person because of my brain injury. So for me, I'm honestly saying this because not very many people do, that I'm glad I had the brain injury, and I would not have ever taken it away if I could go back in time.
And I feel absolutely, I feel the same way. I mean, what I usually say is I wouldn't want, so I really like where I am now. I wouldn't want to give that up, No, I don't particularly want to repeat the nightmare of acute and short-term recovery. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I am glad that I had the brain injury. I mean, it sounds awful, but it's true.
You know, and the two of you are not only the only people I hear say that. So many people will tell me that they feel they're a better person after brain injury. I know for me, and I as a caregiver now, I would like to turn back the time, the clock. However, saying that, only because things would be a little bit easier, David and I would be able to do some of the things that I would like to be able to do that we can't do any longer. But even saying that, I'm content in the life that we have. I still have David with me. I feel he's different. He doesn't seem so different other than his physical disabilities, but I feel that he's a different person. He's different from the man that I married. He's different from the man that I knew on January 12th, 2005. but I like this guy, you know, too. I really do like him. So, and we've made a life together. It's almost like I've had two different husbands in a way, you know? So, yeah. And the thing is, I have made so many wonderful friends, and I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I wouldn't be a voice of brain injury awareness either, because I would never have thought about it, and there would have been no reason for me to have been. But because this happened, I'm looking to see, and I wasn't doing it actively, but I kind of fell into things like, okay, I can do this. I can help other people learn about brain injury. And, I mean, through my book, number one, but that didn't happen until 2018. So we're talking a lot of years. We're talking about 13 years after David's brain injury. But in 2014, I was invited to be a host on this radio show. Who would have thought it? I mean, I never had any aspirations to being, you know, any doing radio show, especially a live show. Are you kidding me? You know, so, but that's those are the kinds of things that happen, and you don't ever know where your life is going to go. You don't know from one minute to the next what's going to happen. And so when something does happen, when you've got the lemons, you make the lemonade, you know, and that's what I think that we all have to consider. We all have to think about that. And our lemonade can all be different. You know, it doesn't have to be the same lemonade. Mine is going to be through my writing. It's going to be through the radio show. It's going to be through the social media groups. And that's how I'm going to make I'm going to help other people through those venues. Jamie, you've got your voice too now you started out here on the Brain Injury Radio Network as a host and moved on to bigger and better things. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. No, just other things. Sorry. So we're all finding different ways. Deb's working, using her talents to write books too. She has another book out that I mentioned earlier, but my brain had other ideas. So we're all using our talents to work, help work around the brain injury, or me as a caregiver, to help other people, you know, and you can't ask for anything better than that.
As you said, I like to say, when you're climbing up the mountain of life and you get caught in a metaphorical avalanche that slides you down to the bottom, you have two choices. Stay there, lament, complain, feel depressed, or climb an alternative peak. And that's what we're all doing. We're all climbing an alternative peak. And guess what? It's not the same peak. It's not going to be the same exact life. It has correlation with recovering from COVID. You're not going to recover and be living exactly the same life as you were living last year at this time before COVID.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. You're not going to go back to that person. You're not going to go back to that life. After a brain injury, you're not going to go back to who you were before. But you can build a miraculous life after. and things might change. Yeah. Just think about it creatively. So that's a huge thing that I found really relevant in my recovery process, is to think creatively. And if you're having struggles mm-hmm. and things aren't working and challenging, like we've hinted at in a couple of different questions, think creatively. And something that sums it up, it's a different story, but I have a friend who got his leg amputated due to cancer. That's very visible. Mm-hmm. He no longer has a leg. It could be very depressing. He's a teenager. Or he could climb an alternative peak. He could see what he could do, which was Paralympic snowboarding, and he kept competing. He went to the Paralympics. He won the Paralympics. And now he
wow.
has a life that he wanted to create. So he created his own luck by climbing an alternative peak. And that's what you can do after a brain injury. You're not going to go back to exactly who you were before. It's not going to be exactly the same life. But if you think creatively, you can build a life that you love after a brain injury.
The thing
yeah.
is, I mean, it's, I mean, so I totally agree with you. But let's be honest. I mean, there are going to be times when you're going to need to wallow. There are going to be times where you're going to need to be, there are times when you're going to be on a plateau. It is harder. There's no question about it. But my life is fuller. And that was a choice that I made.
Mm-hmm.
I made the choice that I wasn't going to lie down and go, oh, woe is me. And the other thing that happens with, for instance, with brain injuries, you become, because you have to learn compensation techniques and coping mechanisms, you become much more of a problem solver. And I think that also helps in the attitude you're talking about, Jamie.
Yes, and I do fully, fully agree with you. I think that's one of the biggest problems with so many people beyond just brain injury in the U.S. and the world is not acknowledging when they feel depressed, when they feel sad, when they're having struggles. You know what? It is hard. And there's different challenges that happen in all sorts of different life. But with a brain injury, you're going to have challenges that are going to be harder for you. And it's okay to feel sad. I actually started going to psychotherapy about 8 months after my brain injury. I was realizing that I was not going to go back to competing, and I was having a really hard time. And so I went to psychotherapy, and one of the biggest things I learned in that process that I've stuck with me through life is that it's okay to feel bad.
Right.
I feel like if
right.
we're having a bad day and we're crying, we should try to push it off. We should try to shove it. We should try to hide it. You know what? Now when I feel sad, because I still have days when I feel sad, I'll like watch
mm-hmm.
sad movie or listen to sad songs, or I will like try to make myself cry. Because then when it's done, I feel so much better, and it's like this big weight is taken off. But that's the
yeah.
thing. You're going to have bad days. So don't try to pretend that you don't have any bad days, and don't try to negate it and push it to the side. Let it out and let yourself have bad days, because it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I think, well, as you said, well, we're all saying, it's so important communicating this to the public, because you get brain injury survivors who think they're dealing with things inadequately because they are depressed and they're having trouble getting out of that depression. They think they're being inadequate because other people think they're lazy, and maybe they are being lazy, and they start doubting themselves. And then on the other hand, and then there's the point of view of the caregiver that having to say no to various social occasions because they're dealing with a caregiver. There's all this stuff that needs to be communicated to not only to the public at large, but to medical personnel, sometimes the caregiver or the brain injury survivor themselves, because I know that for the longest time I didn't understand why I was having I didn't understand that I was having trouble with sensory overload. I thought there was something wrong with me, in the sense of that I'm dealing with things inadequately, I'm being too emotional, this kind of thing. So brain injury survivors also need to hear these things. Caregivers need to hear these things, because there might be something that you didn't pick up on from your own experience, that you didn't have that self-awareness that is triggered by that could be triggered by someone else mentioning something similar. And so I think that talking about these things between ourselves, certainly, because we gain a better understanding of what we're all going through, but, you know, educating the public, talking to people about it, it's you know, I think it makes a huge difference, and it will continue making a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Exactly.
And I totally agree, which is why I'm so excited to just keep the voice out for caregivers, because there's no training. You don't prepare for this role. You're just thrust into the role of being a survivor or a caregiver. Neither one plans for it. And then, at the same time, it is scientifically proven that taking naps is really good for you, for everybody, regardless of having a brain injury or not. So if you have a brain injury and you take naps every day, you know, when I had my brain injury for months and months after, I would take 2 naps a day. I would wake up and I'd be really active, and then I'd take a nap. And then I would be really active, and then I'd take another nap. And then I'd go to bed at like 8 o'clock, and I'd sleep through. But so I took lots of naps, and that's really good for you and really healthy. And it's scientifically proven that taking naps, which is why so many different countries have siestas as part of their lifestyle. Yet in the U.S., we think it's bad to have to take a nap, and that means we are not valuable. We are not up to being an adult. Little kids take naps. If an adult takes a nap, they should try to pretend that they don't take a nap. No.
Yeah.
It's scientifically proven it's great to take naps, and if that's what you need to do, your brain injury recovery, then take a nap, but don't feel bad about taking a nap. So I agree with you so much that communication and awareness about these different aspects of brain injury recovery in caregivers and survivors are so relevant, because it's a role that neither of them prepare for, and there's not that much educational material out there for survivors or caregivers. There's some scientific material out there for doctors that's pages and pages of scientific material. That's not what we need. We need to know that it's okay to take a nap and not to feel bad about taking our nap.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is one of the reasons I wrote my book, was because when I came out of hospital, I was looking for something that, you know, information, you know, so there's the medical books, there's books by caregivers, and that's not what I needed. I needed to look from the inside. I needed stories by brain injury survivors to try and understand what's going on with me, and where do I go from here. And I didn't find anything back then. There was very little. The brain injury survivors that did write were focused on the trauma and acute recovery. And I needed more than that. So I ended up writing the book because I felt, well, A, I thought it would help me along figuring it out for myself, but also so, you know, that other brain injury survivors would have, you know, a resource that might help them. So, yeah, this whole... It's we all agree, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So another update from David here. Tampa Bay scored a field goal. Tampa Bay is now at 31, Kansas City 9, with 3 minutes left in the third quarter, which I'm sure the third quarter is now over, because that was a long time ago we brought that in. I'm rooting for Tampa Bay. No, yes, I'm rooting for Tampa Bay because they're ahead. I feel like winning today. So, okay, anyhow, I have some friends on social media. Don't you want to be a winner? Yeah, I want to be a winner today. So I asked some friends on social media what they most wanted folks to know about their experiences with brain injury. And I asked them, and they gave me permission to use their comments and using their first name. So Lacey said, let me try first. And she needs time to work out a problem first before a caregiver or someone steps in to help. And as a caregiver, I ran into this problem with David. When he returned from the hospital, he was unable to do anything for himself. And I really did have to do everything for him. I was so lacking, and he appreciated my help. But as the years passed and he became more able, he wanted to do things for himself. And I think it had a lot to do with regaining his self-esteem. So sometimes, even more than 16 years later, I try to step in and make life easier for him. But many times he makes it clear that he doesn't want my assistance. And at first, I have to admit, I was hurt when he refused my help. I kind of clammed up because I just felt like, oh, well, that's not very nice. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to make this better for you, and you're getting a little annoyed at me. So I thought, okay. But anyhow, after he told me that he had a routine, and when I tried to help him, it upset his routine, making his job harder, I understood. So again, there we go with communication. Another friend suggested that survivors ask their family and friends to think before they speak. A lot of people need to do that. But hard feelings can be averted when folks consider what their words may mean to a survivor. So another friend wrote, ask your family and friends to use their imagination. Start with sentences, and I think this is a good tool. Start with sentences with imagine, and then when you're describing injuries and symptoms. So think about sensory overload. Deb, you talked about this a lot, so I want to bring this in. So imagine when lights and sounds become overwhelming to the point of distraction. So let's try this. I thought about this a little bit earlier, and so both of you, imagine everybody in the audience here. Imagine you're walking on a New York City street, and the noise of people talking, the crowds of people moving and pushing, the horns honking, send you over the edge, and you become completely immobile. How do you feel? That experience can also easily happen to a survivor with no New York City street or horns honking. It can happen with a simple cry of a baby or by the bark of a dog or something so mundane as the drip of a water faucet. So I actually think the imagine game can be a good way to explain to non-survivors how unsettled a brain can become over something that no one else would even think twice about. What are your thoughts, guys?
Well, as I said, I think explaining in terms of relatable examples is really crucial. I mean, for instance, with the neurofatigue stuff, well, first of all, I used to refer to it as extreme fatigue or sudden onset fatigue or extreme exhaustion. And when I think it was from you, Donald, I first heard the term neurofatigue, and then I'm going, yes, that's it. And once you use that term, immediately people realize that there's something more to it than their usual tiredness or something. There's something else going on. But then I my daughter's now pregnant, and she didn't really understand the whole fatigue thing until she was telling me about her fatigue from the pregnancy. And I said to her, yes, that's like neurofatigue. But your average person, I mean, not everyone has gone through a pregnancy, but, you know, that's the best you can do. Or when I talk about sensory overload, I talk about task initiation. I talk in terms of, okay, think about a project. You've just finished a long involved project and you need to move on to the next one immediately and you can't. So it's a similar sort of feeling with a brain injury survivor having trouble initiating a task.
But I think that those kinds of games, I mean, that kind of it's a tool. It's a tool to use that you can figure out how someone is feeling inside. I have to just bring up this other friend wants caregivers to know that, and I think this is really important, and I don't think people think about it enough. So now that I've whetted your appetite with wanting to know what she said, Lori says that, it's very hurtful when people complain about their survivors. And so she wrote, and this is a quote, "I would like all caregivers to know that when they are on a support group, such as a social media group, a group page like that, that has both survivors and care providers, it is not a place for you to vent about the survivor you are caring for or about how horrible your life has become as a result. And I totally agree with Lori. I'm not saying that caregivers don't need to vent too, because they do. But Lori also realizes that they do. And she acknowledges that the role of caregiver is not an easy one. She only asks that caregivers vent in rooms provided just for caregivers. Or, if it's not social media, out of the hearing of a survivor. You can have conversations with your friends, and you can vent and get your feelings out with a friend, but your survivor shouldn't have to hear it, because it's hard enough for them already. They already know that they're a burden. Most of them feel that. They feel that horrible feeling of being, you know, ruining your life or something like that. So, Lori, I think she has a great point. And survivors, you know, like I said, are dealing with enough already. They simply don't need to know that caregivers are resentful or that they're overburdened. Lori said that she internalizes what others are saying about their survivor, and then she applies it to herself, and it makes her feel like less of a person. And so, you know, Lori, if you're listening to this, I hope you'll hear that, you know, you are not less of a person. And I think it is kind of rude for people to vent in front of people like that. You know, it's just not nice. Anyhow.
And so, something that was very interesting in my injury, when I was in the hospital, the doctor wanted to talk about my statistics of my recovery, which were very low, in front of me, because I was in the coma.
Yes.
And Prue actually made him leave the room. She was like, excuse me, you cannot talk in front of my daughter about this stuff. And
yeah.
He said, oh, she's in a coma. And he said, I don't care.
Excellent.
She said, I don't care.
Excellent.
And then when I was recovering, I had amnesia, serious amnesia for 6 weeks. So I don't have any memory of that time of my life. And in that time, I told this story over and over again about how I just wanted to be normal. I just wanted to be normal. I had been a professional skier traveling the world. I was very far from normal. I had never wanted to be normal in my life. But all of a sudden, I just kept talking about wanting to be normal. And they said, why? And I said, because that man said I was never going to be normal again. He said I could never be normal again. And I really want to be normal. And that's when my mom was like, she got chills and it shook her, because she continued when I was in the hospital. There was one time my aunt came to visit and she wanted to talk about how they were going to deal with me if I never regained my, the doctors kept saying I was never going to live independently. So they're like, so she was like, so what are you going to do now that you have Jamie living with you for life? And
oh,
I was like, oh, we don't talk about that. And it wasn't because she thought that I was going to or that I wasn't, but that you don't talk about it in front of the people, because the people take that internally. And that's exactly what she's talking about, is that if your caregivers are saying you're such a burden, even if they're not your caregivers, if some caregivers are, then you think that that is what you are doing. And you internalize that. And then your self-esteem, your confidence, all the things that can make you shine, they just filter out and they diminish the light because you feel like you're inadequate, even if you're not, even if nobody thinks that you're a burden, but they think that somebody else is a burden. If they say that, then you internalize it and you think about it as meaning yourself.
And that's exactly what Lori is thinking.
He's actually about to die. So there's a possibility I might disappear.
Okay. Well, we'll know why. But, you know, reappear some other time on my show, Jamie, please. I know you're scheduled to.
I already booked it right now.
What's that?
I said I already.
Oh, yes, you did.
You booked the days.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. So I just want to bring up a last point because our time is running out. Oh, my gosh. It goes so fast, and we have so many things to talk about. But I think the caregivers want their survivors to know that they're doing their best, but they weren't trained for the job, as we mentioned earlier. Like me, many caregivers were thrown into the deep end with no lifesaver. 1 minute, my life was fine. I was a wife, a mom, a school teacher, and then I was 100% caregiver too. The rest of them didn't go away, but I also became a caregiver, and I didn't know what to do. I was learning right along with my husband, David, what brain injury meant. I used common sense, of course, and caring and patience, and sometimes I got it right. Well, I guess a lot of times I did, but many times I failed. And I just mentioned to you about the thing earlier about failing, how I wanted to help David, and sometimes I still do that. And I should know better by now. You think 16 years learning this, I should figure it out. But I didn't. And it wasn't until we communicated about it that I did learn and I understand. It's not to say I'm not going to do it again, but I'm going to try hard not to. You know, I'm going to, because I understand it more. So
it's conversations. Sorry.
That's okay.
Just from our conversations, I've learned so much about my ex's how he was dealing with it, and he, as you said, he had no training. And I'm much more empathetic than I was before you and I started talking about these things. I understand it better, and you're right. I wish I'd been more understanding before.
Yeah, but again, you're not trained to. You're not expected to. How are you supposed to know? You know, but one of the things that, we figured out another path because I was, some things I was doing wrong, so we had to figure it out. And I had to find a way to make both my life and David's life more joyful. And so David and I use laughter a lot. You know, laughter can gloss over a troubled time. It makes us laugh and helps us to not take ourselves so seriously. It makes us forget that difficult time, any difficult times that we stumbled through, and laughter and humor work for us. And I think it can work for a lot of survivor caregiver teams too. But you know, it does take that communication, and we're all back down to communication because that's truly what it's all about. And on that note, Deb, and I see that Jamie did get dropped already, so I will thank her anyway for being on the show, and I do have to do my housekeeping duties at the end so that the next host can come on. So, Deb, I want to thank you very, very much for joining me tonight. Deb Brandon at debbrandon.com. Please find out more about Deb. She's got lots going on. You can read interviews. And you can find, I did say this earlier, but you can find interviews or information about Deb Brandon and Jamie Crane Mosey, M-A-U-Z-Y, on my website, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just put their name in the search box and lots of things will come up. There'll be a lot of other things on that same website, brain injury resources. I told you the COVID-19 category is there, so you can learn a lot more about what's going on COVID from the scientist's mouth. But put into layman's terms, so it's understandable. There's a place for guest bloggers. There's a place for itty-bitty giant steps. There's a place where you can find out about Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. But frankly, if I were you, I would go to DonnaFigurski.com to learn about that book because there's a lot more there. Oh, I never even told anybody. I did say that the audiobook is out, but for the month of February, Amazon Kindle is featuring the ebook for $1.99. You gotta pick it up now because it's really cheap. I mean, in fact, frankly, you can pick up about 10 copies and pass them out to all your friends. It'll never be cheaper than $1.99. So yeah, folks, get on over to Amazon Kindle for that deal. It'll be happening all of February, but you know, get it sooner as you can so you don't miss out. So my next show will be February 21, and my guest will be Ashley Bendixson, She is the author of The Language of Time, a memoir. And it's a book about how Ashley was thrown into being a caregiver. In no time at all, her mother developed Alzheimer's when she was just 48 years old. So you can imagine Ashley is quite a young woman. And she wrote a delightful book, and we're going to talk about that on February 21st. So as I always say, if you liked my show, please tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. And I see the clock just ticked up to 6:50 Pacific time, so we have to say goodbye. But please stay tuned to the next show with Matt Duffin. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And I'll see you on February 21st with The Language of Time by Ashley Bendixson. So that should be a really fun show, too. And, so with that, I'm going to say goodnight, Deb. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. Deb Brandon, author of But My Brain Had Other Ideas.
Good night,
everybody.
You.
Oh, wait, before I go, I have to give the last update on the score. I think I didn't give this one yet. Or maybe I did. Oh, I think I did. Last one was 3 minutes left in the third quarter. Yeah, I gave it. So anyhow, I don't know what it is. So folks, go ahead and now you can tune into the Super Bowl now that we're through. All right. Good night, everybody. Have fun. See you in 2 weeks. Bye, Deb.